Divine presence for me is most characterized by love. And of course, sometimes that sort of divine presence of love is experienced primarily as a challenging presence, a demanding presence.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. As human beings, I think we have a complicated relationship with nature. For starters, we forget we're part of it, and so we think of it as a thing that's happening to us. And while primitive people once interpreted the sun and moon and stars as inexplicable gods or something divine, we often think we've moved beyond that because we have science to help explain things and, for many of us, a monotheistic belief in God. And yet, when something bad happens in the world, like a tornado or a fire or an earthquake, we often instinctually try to make it mean something, like, is God punishing those people? Or if my house was damaged in an earthquake, but my neighbor's wasn't, what did I do wrong? Which just makes me think I don't actually understand the connection between nature and the divine, and us, as well as I might. And when we make up those stories in our minds, what are we searching for? Are we just trying to make sense of a universe that's beyond our comprehension and control? What would happen if we just said, oh, this disaster happened, without assigning the entire universe a motive in punishing me in a flood that impacts thousands of people? So I was fascinated to speak with the author of The Great Search, John Philip Newell. He's a Celtic teacher and author now living in Scotland, and he's written over 15 books and has been described as having, quote, the heart of a Celtic bard and the mind of a Celtic scholar.
I would define spirituality, I think, in terms of awareness of the spiritual dimension of life, and that path of spirituality, I think, sometimes opens to deeper awareness of one's inner life, accessing the soul. I think it also, though, and especially in the Celtic world from which I draw so heavily, spirituality is also about awareness of the spiritual dimension within Earth and looking for the life within all life, or the light at the heart of all things. I think spirituality also raises our awareness not just about our own inner life and about the light within all life, but I think that it is very much to do with looking for the divine in one another and asking, how are we to live, therefore, in relation to this divine essence at the heart of one another as people, as races, as nations, and so on.
You use a really intriguing story at the beginning. You're quoting someone talking about Moses and the burning bush. And what it left me thinking, and I think this was your intent, is we often think of something special descended on that bush that burned and yet was not consumed, that it was unique in all of creation, so Moses goes and looks. But it sounds like actually that is something that is always present, and Moses somehow was just given a vision or a glimpse of it in just that bush. But there is something divine, as you talk about. It made me think not only of the whole world around me, how I could see it differently, but the individual people within it. Is that where you were heading with that?
Yes, absolutely. And in relation to that story, I reference my brother, Rabbi Nachum Ward Lev from New Mexico, and what he says about that story. And of course, it is a very significant story in Hebrew scripture. It's the first story of divine self-disclosure in the Hebrew tradition. Nachum likes to say about that story, the important thing is not that the bush was burning, but that Moses noticed, because every bush is burning. And it's a story that invites us to see not just a particular bush on fire with divine presence, but it reveals the fact that the whole universe can be seen as a burning bush. And it's a way to see ourselves as well, to see you as a burning bush, to look for the light that comes from within you. One of the things I've really appreciated about particularly the Jewish understanding of revelation is that Martin Buber, for instance, says that the greater the story of revelation, the more deeply it is pointing to what is at the heart of all things. This is pretty instructive to those of us in other traditions as well, because one of the tendencies in Western Christianity, for instance, has been to see the revelation of the divine in Jesus as an exception to the universe, or as an exception to what is at the heart of all people. And I would prefer to say that, yes, he is a great revelation of the divine, but he's showing us the light that is at the heart of you and the light that is at the heart of all people.
I think usually we seek spirituality in a very inner way, very personal, one-on-one. And yet you've talked about learning just now to see that fire, so to speak, in others. What is the balance between seeking spirituality individually or having community somehow to do that together?
It's really important to expand it beyond an individual discipline or practice. And part of this, of course, relates to the profound interrelatedness of life that certainly great spiritual traditions have been pointing to, the sense of an essential oneness to all things. But this emphasis on interrelatedness, of course, is coming to us now through every great discipline of thought, inviting us to know our interconnectedness with Earth, inviting us to know that what we do to a part, we do to the whole, that the well-being of the part can only happen in relation to serving the well-being of the whole. And that's not to neglect the part. That's not to neglect the uniqueness of each one of us. But it is to say that we are part of a whole. I certainly know in my own life, to take meditative practice, for instance, an important part of my day is to meditate for half an hour first thing in the morning. It's something I love. It's something I know is good for my soul. It more deeply prepares me for being more deeply present to the people I encounter and to my experience of the day. So I see it as really important and I commit myself to it. But when I get to meditate with a whole group, as I do on Iona during our pilgrimage weeks or during our Earth and Soul retreats in America and Canada and elsewhere, that is qualitatively different for me. It's even greater than just meditating on my own. There's a sort of collective energy that is tangible for me. It's a reminder that we belong to one another and that we can nurture one another in presence. This always asking, how does my personal practice of spirituality, how does it relate to who I am in family life, in work life, in community life? Is it strengthening me to be more of a presence of love? And that's the real measuring rod for any spiritual tradition or any spiritual practice. Is it leading me to be more compassionate? Is it leading me to be more true and faithful to the well-being of those around me?
Because you speak much of the earth in this search, it seems pretty logical and obvious. If I pollute the earth around me, I may reap physical bad effects. Or if I get rid of all the trees because I need them for fuel or building or whatever, without thought for the future, there could be flooding and there could be erosion. There could be a lack of food suddenly. So all of these obvious physical things, but you take that further into a spiritual connection. And I wonder if you talk about how the earth itself is connected to our spirituality.
I think it is a sort of primal awareness, and we find great native traditions have known this profoundly before being dominated or conquered by Western religious traditions or Western culture. So that I think it is a matter of relearning or awakening again to what our soul knows, and that is that we are better when we're in true relationship with Earth. So how do we tend that interrelationship of soul between my soul and our soul and Earth's soul? One of the reasons in the book that I chose Thomas Berry for the first chapter. Thomas Berry was a theologian, a Christian theologian, but he preferred to call himself a geologian. Such was his love of Earth and his belief in the sacredness of Earth and of the cosmos. One of the points he makes is that the universe has been a spiritual reality as well as a physical reality since the great flaring forth of light 13.8 billion years ago. And to look for the spiritual within every manifestation of the universe, 17th century rationalism, for instance, increasingly moved humanity out of relationship with Earth.
That we were somehow above it because of our intelligence?
Yeah, I think therefore I am, and a particular type of consciousness was glorified in humanity, and forgetting that there is consciousness deep in all matter. The universe became a very unenchanted place.
When you say that, it really strikes me how we look at maps and how easily we adopt these artificial divisions and lines that, to us, I think, become more real than mountains or rivers as boundaries. And once I was flying over the U.S. and I looked out the window crossing some of those straight line borders like Wyoming and Nebraska, and I realized how unrelated those are to the land. And I guess I was just struck by the foolishness of people sitting in an office somewhere drawing boundaries over land they know nothing about. But also how easily we accept these constructs, even when we're looking at the very real Earth. And all those man-made ideas of ownership suddenly seemed meaningless to me. I'm curious if you could share a moment or two where you felt that connection, whether a situation or a thought you were having, a place you were, whatever might have facilitated that.
There are particular places that have been significant for me. I happen to be living in Fintorn in Scotland, and before that in Edinburgh. But I have, for many years, I've described Iona, the Isle of Iona in the Western Isles, as the home of my heart, or the place where I experience a very deep connection with the spiritual within myself, within others, within Earth. George MacLeod, the founder of the modern day Iona community and one of my most important teachers in my life, he used to speak of Iona as a very thin place. And by that he meant there was a very sort of thin separation between spirit and matter, or between heaven and earth, or between the divine and the human. He went on to say, in a place like Iona and other sacred sites are almost like sacraments or almost like icons to remind us about the thinness of every place, every moment and every encounter. We've been speaking about everything as both essentially spiritual and physical. And I think Iona is a place, whether it's in relation to the quality of light at sunrise or at sunset, or the quality of the whiteness of the moon above us, or this sort of shining greenness of Earth and what's growing on that island, I much more immediately am aware of the spiritual at the heart of all things. And very, very importantly, not to cling to a place like Iona, or not to feel that I can only access the spiritual there, but rather receive the grace of Iona and the grace of such experiences to make me attentive to the presence of the sacred wherever I am and whatever encounter I'm involved in.
I really appreciated in your book, The Great Search, that you draw from so many sources of wisdom, and you've structured it according to three questions. I always appreciate a good outline to organize my thinking, so I was very happy seeing that. The first one is, what are we seeking? Then why are we searching, and how are we to search? What are we seeking? Is it the same thing, all of us?
I think that there is a growing yearning to be in true relationship with Earth. So what are we searching for is very much looking for true relationship and true sense of interrelationship with Earth, and that sort of vision of the sacred in all things is a characteristic of the Great Search today. By the Great Search, I am in part referring to the yearnings that are deep within many who have become disenchanted with their own religious traditions. So in the case of Christianity, I would say millions of our brothers and sisters who began life within the four walls of our religious inheritance are no longer there. So we need to ask why. And I think it's important to ask, what are we yearning for? And paying attention to our yearnings is a really significant part of moving into new beginnings. I quote the young Jewish woman philosopher who managed to escape Paris just before the Nazi occupation during World War II. She speaks about the efficacy of desire. And by that, she means that getting in touch with the deepest yearnings or desires of our soul translates those deep stirrings up into greater consciousness in us. And from that place of greater clarity and consciousness, we can more readily nurture and embody these yearnings. Paying attention to things like the desire to experience sacred or divine presence, not just in religious moments, but in every moment of our lives and in every encounter. These are yearnings that are very close to the heart of many of us who have left the four walls, as it were, of our religious traditions. And that's not to say that these yearnings are not also in many who remain within the four walls and are trying to be faithful to their inheritance.
Your third question, how are we to search? I'm really intrigued by, because to feel a lack, or maybe not recognizing it as a lack so much as that yearning that you've talked about, I think that is, of course, very human, very universal, that there's something more, or I feel to seek for something. Talk to me about ways we can search that will be efficacious.
Part of the great search for wisdom and the great yearning for wisdom is to reaccess what in Hebrew scripture is spoken of as the wisdom that was born within us in our mother's womb. So it's not about accessing an exterior wisdom. It's not receiving wisdom from a hierarchy of truth above us, but it's learning to access this wisdom of soul that is ours. It's a birthright, and it's about waking up to a type of wisdom of soul that is deep within us. So it's not about invoking a separate wisdom. It's about delving deep into a way of knowing, a way of seeing that was fashioned in us in our mother's womb.
That sounds almost like being led to something and then recognizing it.
Yes, that's right. I had a lovely experience years ago around the time that I had written one of my first books, which is called Listening for the Heartbeat of God. It's derived from a very cherished image in the Celtic world that John the Beloved, who is described in scripture as having leaned against Jesus at the Last Supper, that he therefore heard the heartbeat of God. It became a symbol of the practice of listening for the beat of the sacred deep within ourselves, listening for the beat of the sacred within one another and within the body of earth. So those were some of the themes that I was exploring in the book, and particularly looking at the way in which the Celtic tradition knows that when we look into the face of a newborn child, we're looking into the face of God, freshly born among us. So I was giving a talk on some of these themes in Virginia. A woman, I think in her 80s, came very purposefully up the central aisle of the church with a copy of Listening for the Heartbeat of God in her hand. And she was walking up the aisle so purposefully that the naughty boy in me thought, she's going to hit me over the head with that book. But I was quite wrong, thank God. When she got up to me and she said, I want to show you what I wrote in this book after reading it. And she opened the cover, and inside she had written, I knew it, I knew it, I knew it. I often wish I had asked her for that copy, because she had said so simply, so succinctly, what our experience is when we hear wisdom that has been neglected. We may never have been taught it. We may never have heard it. But when we do finally hear it, our deep response is, ah, I knew it. And paying attention to that deep knowing is an important part of the way forward. And I think one of the things I explore a bit in the book is these different faculties of knowing in us, because often we've thought that the mind and the realm of reason is the only faculty for accessing wisdom and truth. But the realm of intuition and instinct, the realm of the imagination, these are all faculties of knowing. And it's important to be alive to those ways of knowing, with those ways of perceiving.
I like that you include with all of our searching, you said, as Jesus said, seek and you will find. So there is hope in this search that we can connect with what we yearn for, or what we may, I knew it, but haven't quite recognized yet. I wonder if I could ask, what is divine presence to you? And I'm guessing that's something different than it was 20, 30 years ago.
That's a great question. I draw from different teachers in this book, and they come from different centuries, different parts of the world, different religious traditions. But there's something that also unites these prophetic voices from many different centuries, from many religious traditions. In their wonderfully varied ways, they are all saying God is love, and those who live in love live in God, and God lives in them. That particular wording, of course, comes through our Christian scripture. But we find something very similar in all the great spiritual traditions. So I would say that divine presence is characterized first and foremost by a presence of love. And I'm not just meaning romantic love, I'm certainly including that, but I'm talking about the love that we know as brothers and sisters, the love that we can experience with other life forms, the love that manifests itself in terms of movements for justice and movements for real change in society, but also in our relationship with Earth. Divine presence for me is most characterized by love. And of course, sometimes that sort of divine presence of love is experienced primarily as a challenging presence, a demanding presence.
Like a call to respond or to act?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that a presence of love does not tolerate the egocentricity, whether at an individual level or whether that be at a national level or a species level. I think a presence of love is calling us to be and to care for one another's well-being. And this is a principle, again, that we find in all the great spiritual traditions. The golden rule of do to others as you would wish them to do to you.
Yes.
That again comes under the sort of umbrella of divine presence being presence of love.
In my own tradition, you're making me think of the list of the fruits of the Spirit, of peace, joy, and love. But yeah, in that particular verse, I'd never connected that with the call to thus act differently.
Yes.
That seemed like more of an inner gauge. But I like what you're saying about that. That can move us to act in the interest of the earth itself, our home, mm-hmm, or our brothers and sisters, fellow beings. That's beautifully stated. John Philip Newell, what a pleasure to speak with you. Is there something I should ask you that I don't know to ask?
I suppose one of the things I would want to say about this new book is that it is talking about the big story. We're living in a moment of immense transition as old systems of authority and religious belief are collapsing. What are we searching for? What are we yearning for? And that's important to me, and that's primarily what the book is about. I also always am looking for an integration between the big story and the little story. And by the little story, I mean my own story and my own journey. It's not a book about me, but I want my readers to know that I'm experiencing this search, And in my own life, it led me to relinquish my ordination as a Christian minister because I could no longer hold together the basic tenets of Western Christianity rooted in 4th century doctrines and creeds that were really stipulated by empire. I could no longer make a deep and integrated connection between that and what I'm trying to teach, what I'm sensing, what I'm feeling called to be and to do. The relinquishing of ordination was emphatically not a lack of faith. It was following my faith into new territory and into a more conscious identification with the countless numbers of people who are in religious exile now. And one of the things that's become increasingly clear to me is that deep in our Judeo-Christian inheritance, there's a creative tension between the temple on the one hand and the wilderness on the other, or between the priestly and the prophetic. And I think that these two need one another. I think that they're given to strengthen one another when they can be true to their essential calling. And although I'm much more in the wilderness now and trying to lend my energies to a prophetic voice that's calling for change, not only religious change, but cultural and political change, I think that the prophetic voice must always speak in love for the family, as it were. And I recognize that those who continue to gather in the temple or within the four walls of our religious inheritance, they are my family. I'm a son of the Christian household. I in no sense am sitting in judgment on many of my brothers and sisters who continue the important work of priesthood or ministry, and many of them are doing a really important job of working for change from the inside.
Many thanks to John Philip Newell for speaking with me. If you're a podcast subscriber, we have a bonus episode about the legacy of Pope Francis. Find that on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Heidi Hansen, and James Sturtevant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Ashton Parkinson, and DJ Cromarty. Be sure and sign up for our newsletter at ingoodfaithpodcast.org. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith. Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here, host of In Good Faith. Here's another podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts I hope you'll check out. What I Love is Real. You know that saying, real recognize real? That's Lisa on The Lisa Show. Lisa Valentine Clark is a comedian, she's a believer, a single mother, and on The Lisa Show podcast, you'll hear from the Council of Moms, a genius idea which is actually one of my favorite parts of her show. And you'll hear about the challenges of life, parenting, mental health questions, social issues. Yes, you'll hear from experts, but also from people discussing their where the rubber meets the road life experience. It's The Lisa Show, wherever you get your podcasts.